It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Environmental Protection Agency released new lead contamination guidelines this week in Green Bay. We'll learn more about the changes and their potential impact. First, when you're making a meal, how much thought do you put into your sides? Be honest, do you find yourself reaching for a bag of frozen broccoli, maybe a box of instant mashed potatoes or pre-made buns from the store? No judgment. A survey late last year found that 44% of millennials would bring an already prepared dish to their holiday gathering rather than make one from scratch. A quarter of them said they'd even take credit for making it, but that's another story. Side dishes can be tricky. You have to know what goes well with the main course, and you don't want to keep going back to the same thing again and again. Plus, it's extra time and effort. The folks at America's Test Kitchen are coming out with a cookbook designed to elevate our weeknight meals and dinner parties. It's called The Side Dish Bible, 1,001 perfect recipes for every vegetable, rice, grain, and bean dish you will ever need. It hits shelves on November 5th. Dan Zuccarello is the executive food editor of cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. Dan, welcome back to Food Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Well, side dishes, sometimes they're a second thought. How important are they for a meal?
Well, you have it exactly. I mean, I think for something that makes up such a large part of our dinner plate, it's often the last thing we think about. So, for this project, we really wanted to put side dishes center stage and give them the attention that they deserved.
And when I see recipes online, it seems like the fun stuff that people are really into is the entree. Do we just unfairly neglect that side dish in the food eating world?
Well, the thing is that side dishes, you know, there's a lot of challenges that come with side dishes, right? I mean, I think, first of all, for me particularly, there's sometimes just too many options. You know, I kind of relate it to the Netflix epidemic where you have so many things to choose from, you almost don't even want to make a choice. And so part of, you know, doing a book like this was kind of engineering the structure of the book to make, you know, coming up with the side dish that you thought was perfect for your meal, easily, you know, easy to navigate and easy to find. And then there's also clearly this flavor rut that we get into. You know, there's a lot of options, and, you know, you can get really kind of bogged down by just constantly making the same side dish for every meal. And so we wanted to make sure that we had plenty of options for people to really reinvigorate their meal, right?
Yeah, 1,001 recipes in the book. Give us a sense of the range of the kinds of side dishes you tackle here.
Well, I mean, it's soup to nuts. I mean, with 1,001 recipes, this is the, you know, ultimate book. You will not need another cookbook on side dishes in your kitchen. And like I said, we really tried to think about how best to navigate the vast landscape of side dishes. The book starts off with a chapter really focused on the essentials, quick, easy recipes that you can throw together. Most of them are done in 30 minutes or less. But at the same time, we kind of thought about other experiences that people are going through throughout the year and organized the chapters based on that. So clearly there's a section on the holidays. Plenty of space devoted to potatoes, the favorite side dish, of course. A lot of, really interesting things with casseroles, salads, unique ways to use vegetables and grains that aren't just kind of the classic, steamed sides.
Talking to Dan Zuccarello from America's Test Kitchen on this edition of Food Friday, talking about their new book, The Side Dish Bible. Well, Dan, you shared a few recipes with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's one of the more straightforward ones, I think. Skillet broccoli with olive oil and garlic. And you gave this and all the recipes the usual Test Kitchen treatment. You did your mad scientist work on this to find ways to make this broccoli a little crispy on the outside, but still cook through on the inside, not the like mushy boiled broccoli that some people might think of. Talk us through how this works out.
Yeah, I love this recipe. I mean, like I said, you know, there's nothing wrong with a simple side dish, right? It doesn't always have to be really complicated. But this recipe really shows how easy it can be to kind of take it to the next level, right? The olive oil and the garlic being the flavors here. But we also have a variation with sesame oil and ginger. The kind of brilliance of this recipe is in how simple it is. We start with a really hot skillet. We start by browning the broccoli, and then we steam it. We cover it. We add a little bit of water. We took inspiration from classic stir-fry techniques. This is often what you see when you're stir-frying vegetables, this whole combination of saute and steam. And so what you end up with is a really quick, it's done in less than 20 minutes, technique for cooking broccoli. And we add the olive oil and garlic at the end so that the garlic doesn't burn, but there's just enough time for it to really coat the broccoli and give it some really great flavor. It's a really easy side dish, really delicious.
And you've solved a problem for me on what goes wrong on my stir fry sometimes, because I, you know, fry it in the pan or wok when I had a wok. And then it's good on the outside, but not ready on the inside. By the time it's cooked through, it's kind of burning on the outside. So the fry then steam concept actually could change my cooking a lot. That's pretty handy.
Yeah, I use this idea a lot. Sometimes I'll incorporate the microwave, actually. If I'm roasting something even, I'll put the vegetables, maybe it's green beans, in a large bowl with maybe a tablespoon or two of water. I'll cover it, microwave it for maybe 4 minutes, just enough time to create some steam in the bowl and to soften the vegetable. Drain the vegetable, maybe on some paper towels, and then just put it into a hot skillet. And that's kind of another way of accomplishing the same thing.
Wow. Okay. Any other tips on thinking of vegetables as our side? This is a pretty common side. Any good techniques that are, again, pretty quick and easy?
Yeah. So, I think the biggest suggestion that I can give your listeners is to think about vegetables beyond just kind of the classic saute or steam. Thinking about incorporating vegetables into a salad, not necessarily serving it warm. Maybe it's roasted and then you let it cool down and you toss it with a vinaigrette. Maybe you add some cheese, some goat cheese or nuts to turn it into more of a salad component. Kind of just taking a step back and thinking, I love to incorporate vegetables into my dinner or my lunch. But it doesn't always have to be, hot, made immediately just before eating.
Before we get back to some of the other recipes you shared with us, do you have thoughts on pairing, picking the right side dish for whatever the main course happens to be?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things that I always, advise people when they're thinking about kind of pairing side dishes. And this happens a lot when we're thinking about having, a few people over for dinner. We've got Thanksgiving right around the corner. It's definitely one of those times where we're thinking a lot about side dishes. The first thing that I would say is think about colors and textures. You want to make sure that you've got something green, something crunchy, something creamy. Thinking about food in the terms of how people are going to enjoy it. In the same way, thinking about this balance of flavors, you're going to want something maybe a little spicy, something a little sweet, maybe something that's really bold with, a pickled ingredient or a vinegar or something like that. And then at the same time, considering, the time it's going to take you to make these side dishes, you don't want everything to have to come out of your oven. And so, like I said, thinking about vegetables in terms of salads that you could be making, or incorporating a piece of equipment like a slow cooker or a pressure cooker to help kind of create these side dishes and take that space and on your stovetop and kind of put it to better use.
Potatoes seem to be one of the most common side dishes out there. And of your 1,001 recipes in this book, I understand, 57 of them are potato themed.
It is the favorite side dish. You have to give plenty of space to it.
And there is a recipe, you shared one of those 57 with us, the super stuffed baked potatoes. These look good. I think that's the one on the cover of the cookbook. So I'm guessing these are pretty good. How does this come together? I've made twice baked potatoes before. Is this a similar sort of arrangement?
Yeah, I think everyone loves a great stuffed potato. It can get a little frustrating because you want to make sure you've got a really creamy interior, but you also want the exterior to be really crispy and well roasted. And so a couple things that we do here that I think are really interesting. First, when you're making a stuffed baked potato, you want it to be stuffed, right? You want plenty of filling. And so what we actually found was we roast an extra baked potato and take the filling and use that as part of the filling for the other potatoes to really make sure that there's plenty of stuffing in there. But one of the other things that we do, like I was mentioning, you really want a crispy exterior. We actually will microwave the potatoes to kind of soften them up. We'll take out the potato filling, and then we'll put the empty shells back in the oven while we're making the mashed potato filling. And that kind of gives time for the skins to really crisp up, get you that texture that you really enjoy, so that there's this really nice contrast between the creamy interior and the crispy exterior. The filling comes together really easy. We use Boursin cheese. It's a seasoned cheese. It's really widely available in the grocery stores, a little bit of half and half. It's a really excellent side dish to incorporate into your weekday meals.
I had to look up that Boursin cheese, and I recognize the packaging. That's a brand name of a kind of cheese. Can we mix and match sort of creamy cheese things to fill it with?
Absolutely. If you can't find Boursin at your grocery store, goat cheese is an excellent substitute. Cream cheese is even a great substitute. There's some fresh chives in the recipe, but you could certainly substitute your favorite herb, parsley, basil, tarragon. They would all work really well.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about side dishes with Dan Zuccarello, executive food editor of cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. Their new book is The Side Dish Bible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite side dish that you'd like to share with us that goes great with what? Fill in the blank there. Do you put a lot of effort into the side dish, or is it an afterthought for you? Do you have a question for our guest about how to prepare any of a wide variety of sides? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're continuing our Food Friday conversation with Dan Zuccarello. He's executive food editor of cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. They've got one coming out on November 5th. It's called The Side Dish Bible, 1001 perfect recipes for every vegetable, rice, grain, and bean dish you will ever need. Call 800-642-1234 if you want to join in. Talk about your side dish game. What is your favorite side to make? What's your favorite potato recipe? Any favorite fall foods that get into your side dishes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jerry is with us in Shawano. Jerry, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Jerry?
Well, this time of the year is just amazing with the types of food, and you always want to eat a little heavier and stuff, but one of the things I really, really love this time of the year is Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And not throwing them in a pot of water with some salt, but taking some time to maybe peel them or quarter them, roast them with bacon and olive oil, you know, maybe sprinkle some cheese and onions or something on it. What are some other thoughts and ideas that get your mouth watering with Brussels sprouts?
That's great, Jerry. Your ideas, I can run a long way with those. Dan, any other ideas for our Brussels sprouts?
Well, I agree. I mean, I absolutely love Brussels sprouts. If some people don't like them because they think they taste a little cabbagey, I absolutely love Brussels sprouts. What comes to mind immediately, we learned this technique. We recently did a recipe for a shaved Brussels sprout salad, and it's absolutely delicious. And it couldn't be easier. You take the Brussels sprouts. I like to trim off the ends, cut them in half, and then take a knife, and I just very thinly slice the Brussels sprouts, toss it with a little bit of lemon juice, some olive oil. I let that sit with some salt just for maybe 15, 20 minutes for the Brussels sprouts to soften, and then I take some Parmesan cheese, and I stir that in there with it. It's absolutely delicious, a really great way to serve Brussels sprouts. Most people are used to cooking the Brussels sprouts, but they're equally well delicious raw. I also really love doing a Brussels sprout gratin. If you haven't done, you know, potato gratin is a favorite of mine as well. But if you have an opportunity to do a Brussels sprout gratin, I think you won't go back.
What is that?
Well, so the caller mentioned, you know, roasting the Brussels sprouts is a really great way to draw out the natural sweetness of Brussels sprouts. But then at the same time, we just make a very quick cream sauce with some cheese, some heavy cream. Once the Brussels sprouts are roasted, just kind of pour that mixture over top, put it back in the oven with some breadcrumbs. And you've got this excellent casserole dish. It's a great way to eat Brussels sprouts.
That sounds fantastic, Jerry. Hope that helps. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We've got another recipe. This is a little bit of a curveball. This is a slow cooker recipe, slow cooker Mexican-style beans. What are there special things we have to do when we're making our beans in the slow cooker?
Well, I love using my slow cooker to make side dishes. I think it's a great way to make a side dish and, like I said earlier, not take up all the space on your stovetop. This is really, you know, a great dish to make if you've got a lot of people coming over. You know, a couple of things that really are great about this recipe, you don't have to soak the beans. You know, we use pinto beans here. They're a smaller bean. You can actually just throw them right into the slow cooker raw. It cooks for 8 to 9 hours, so it's got plenty of time to get nice and tender. We add a little bit of beer to our recipe just for a little bit of extra depth of flavor in the broth. We finish it with some, you know, brown sugar, cilantro, lime juice. Really, really delicious, you know, side dish to do in your slow cooker.
And one tip you give in this recipe is basically put in all the spice you think you're going to need and then put in some more when you're cooking beans in the slow cooker. Why is that?
Well, so the slow cooker, we know, you know, the longer something cooks, the more the flavors can get muted. And this is particularly true for the slow cooker. And so not just for this recipe, but for most of the recipes that we do in our slow cooker, we kind of heavy hand the aromatics. So in this case, it's chili powder. But certainly the onion, the herbs that you might be using in your slow cooker, we kind of use, you know, almost twice as much as we would in a traditional recipe. And really, it's just because those flavors will get muted over time, and we really want to make sure that they're present when we're ready to eat it.
We have that recipe up at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday. Dan Zuccarello is with us from America's Test Kitchen. Their new book coming out in early next month, actually, The Side Dish Bible. We are putting side dishes front and center. Dan, I want to take a step back and talk about your methods at America's Test Kitchen. These recipes we're seeing, they're the end result of you guys usually trying a lot of different methods and subtle permutations, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really approach cooking from an analytical perspective. We don't take anything for granted. And so when we're approaching a recipe, we really try to see what is everyone out there doing? What are the challenges that people are facing? And we try to replicate them in the kitchen so that we can come up with a solution that we think is best for the recipe and gives us the most success. And so it's a long process. We spend weeks on a single recipe just to get it to be perfect before we put it into the book. So like you said, yeah, these recipes are the end result of months and months of testing with multiple test cooks. We actually have a little over 60 test cooks in our kitchens developing recipes for all of our platforms. It's a lot of work, but it's work that we find really valuable.
Out on the market now, there are a lot of different, from our perspective, kind of funky grains, the quinoas and millets and amaranth and things like that. Do you have any fun grain dishes that can really add something completely new to our side dish palette?
Well, one of the grains that I really like lately is farro. It's a kind of ancient grain. You see it a lot of in Italian cooking. I like to treat it very much like rice for a risotto. Most people know how this, you know, risotto, it's a slow-cooked rice dish. You kind of start with a little bit of broth and rice, and you constantly stir it, and the starches from the rice help to thicken the broth, and you get this really luscious, you know, creamy dish. And the same can be done with farro. And you can find farro, again, in most grain sections of the grocery store. The natural food section is probably your best bet if you're looking for it. And again, we like to, in order to get the most starch to kind of come out of the farro, we actually pulse it in the blender a little bit to break down the grains. But again, we put it into a saucepan. Sometimes I like to add a little bit of butter to begin, kind of toast the grains to get a little bit of that nuttiness out. And then I just slowly add warm broth. It could be vegetable broth. It could be chicken broth. And over time, those grains are going to soften, but the starches are going to help thicken the broth. And you end up with this, like I said, really rich, luscious side dish.
Dan, I got to say, I'm kind of risotto avoidant. I've never made it. And the reason is it's a side dish usually, but you got to spend all that time stirring it when you want to be focusing on other parts of the meal. If I can be infomercially, there's got to be a better way, right?
Well, we actually did a technique where we kind of like heavy-handed the broth with our risotto, and we let it go into the oven on a low oven, maybe like 200 degrees for about like 30 minutes. And the truth of the matter is that you can actually let the risotto sit for a while and just kind of soften the grains before you start any stirring. Ultimately, at the end of the cooking, you really do need to stir because that whipping process is what's really giving you that creaminess. But certainly, if you've got your hands tied cooking dinner, you could certainly try, you know, either the saucepan or you could do it in a Dutch oven. But maybe put, twice as much liquid as you think that you need when you're starting off the risotto. Put it in a low oven and just let it cook slowly while you're doing other things. And then right before you're ready to serve, you can kind of give it a quick stir and finish it off.
All right, I want to spend a minute or two on a topic. This is kind of a cooking confession for me, Dan. I'm an okay cook, but for some reason when I make a green salad, I don't know. I don't know how you do that wrong, but I always find it kind of boring. What kind of ideas do you have to make a good green salad in the side dish book?
Yeah, so I keep things really simple when it comes to kind of jazzing up my side dishes. And I like to think of, you know, the basic ingredients that I have in my house and ways to use them. And so, you know, everyone, you know, when they're making a side salad, it's a kind of classic vinegar and oil. So think about different ways to incorporate that tanginess of vinegar. You know, maybe you're using a citrus juice. Maybe it's lemon juice. Maybe it's lime juice. Orange juice is a really great option. Doesn't always have to be olive oil. Maybe it's, you know, avocado oil or a nut oil. Those are easy ways to kind of add some extra flavor. Maybe you throw in a nut or a soft cheese, you know, fresh herbs. These are really simple things. They're things that we all have on hand, but we don't really think about them as options for jazzing up our side dishes. But in particular for a salad, it's a really easy way to kind of get more creative so you don't just have kind of a plain salad for dinner.
That's awesome. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dan Zuccarello, executive food editor of cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. We talked to him about improving our side dish game and Test Kitchen's forthcoming book, The Side Dish Bible, 1001 perfect recipes for every vegetable, rice, grain, and bean dish you will ever need. It hits shelves on November 5th. We've got three of those 1001 recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday, the super stuffed baked potatoes, skillet broccoli with olive oil and garlic, and slow cooker Mexican style beans. Try them out. Let us know how they went on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about lead water contamination in the state and some new guidelines from the EPA. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Amazon put in an order for electric delivery vans. Lots of them. We'll check in on the latest trends in electric vehicles. First, the Environmental Protection Agency unveiled its updated lead contamination guidelines yesterday in Green Bay. Lead in drinking water has been a growing concern in communities across the country and here in Wisconsin. This is the first time in nearly 30 years that the EPA has updated its guidelines regarding lead, but many state environmental groups argue that the new guidelines don't go far enough to protect Wisconsin residents. Our next guest joins us to talk about ongoing efforts in Wisconsin to reduce the amount of lead in drinking water and elsewhere. John Arendt is director of the Environmental Management and Business Institute at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we zoom in on projects in Green Bay and elsewhere in the state, what's your reaction to the news that the EPA is changing these lead contamination guidelines?
Well, you know, it certainly is probably due time to look at the rule and improve it. The last time it was dealt with was 1991. What would be interesting would to be, we'd actually like to know what was in there. We haven't actually seen it. I was at the press conference yesterday at the unveiling, and still at this moment haven't been able to see the actual details of it.
Why do you think Green Bay was chosen as the site to make this announcement in all the country?
Frankly, I think the optics are very good for the EPA to make the announcement. Green Bay has got a program that they've instituted starting back in 2016 to get the utility-owned lead services out and replaced, as well as identified residents' lead services as well. In 2016, there were almost 1,800 utility-owned lead services in Green Bay. Right now, we're down to almost 300, almost 1,500 have been replaced. And homeowners, the ones that have been services that have been identified, originally we found 236. There are less than 20 left to be replaced. Now, of course, homeowners are still encouraged to have their services tested because there may be other lead services out there that the utility doesn't know about.
Looking at lead exposure overall, can you talk about the variety of sources? We've had a lot of focus on water lately. It is not the only source of lead.
You know, frankly, when we look at especially blood level poisoning in children, 80% of the sources are not water. A lot of it tends to be paint. We can find lead in soil. There is lead in the glazing of certain pottery type plates. There are even lead that's been found in candy. Typically not domestic, but there are a variety of sources. Even for those folks that reload their shotguns in homes, there's lead dust that can accumulate, and children can come in contact with it. So there are multiple sources. Water does get a lot of attention. Obviously, it's something we all need.
And that said, is it? Do you see this kind of investment by a community like Green Bay as being worthwhile to get the lead utility lines and homeowner parts of the lines get the lead ones replaced?
No, I think it's very worthwhile. Let's eliminate that potential source. And often, what you see is some of our most vulnerable populations suffering from potential lead poisoning, even in the water supply. You know, a lot of these homes tend to be either minority owned or renter occupied. They're older home stock, so we definitely should seek to remove those lines.
Talking to John Arendt, Director of the Environmental Management and Business Institute at UW Green Bay, looking at lead in water lines and elsewhere. New EPA guidelines coming out, announced in Green Bay this week. A lot of this is happening community by community. I know Madison did a lot with its lead water lines. You're doing this in Green Bay. Is this being done community by community only, or are you seeing state or even federal-wide efforts to replace these lead water services?
I think the attention is moving more on the federal level, but the actual action is really still happening more on a community by community basis.
This has been talked about in the state legislature, but the price tag for doing it all over the state, it is leading some people to pause and slow things down. How is a community like Green Bay paying for something like this?
Green Bay, because of, I think it, part of it is charges from the city utility. You'll see or have seen some gradual increases in the utility bills. But another portion of that has been seeking federal and state funding to help support it. So it has been, that cost has been spread out over time. Like I said, it began in 2016. So we've been able to sort of spread those costs out and not take it as one lump sum and one massive initial effort.
We've seen lead in water become a growing concern for a while, especially since, and it's been quite a while, since Flint, Michigan hit the headlines. They had kind of a perfect storm of different circumstances leading to their lead problem. Do we have anything that reaches that level of concern and severity here in Wisconsin?
I honestly can't speak to that. I am concerned Milwaukee has quite a few lead services that are going to need to be replaced. So, I don't know in terms of lead content in their private water services, but I do know that there are a lot of lead services that will need to be replaced in Milwaukee.
Now, for people who haven't been following this story closely over the years, why are we so particularly concerned about lead as a contaminant, especially when it gets into kids?
Well, there's a lot of things that can happen once children display elevated lead levels. There's certainly behavior and learning issues, lower IQs, hyperactivity, slower growth. We've also seen hearing problems. And this is something that not only the children who have direct contact, pregnant women who are in a situation with high lead levels can pass that on to the fetus. And that can sometimes lead to premature births or even reduced growth of the fetus. So it has quite an effect.
You talked about what Green Bay is doing in terms of lead water lines. Are there other efforts when it comes to those other main sources you mentioned, things like the paint and the soil?
Yes. I actually happen to sit on the Brown County Lead Abatement Coalition, and we are made up of not only county nursing staff and educators, but also some of the local cities. We have representation from the state. Myself from the university, and we also have someone from the Green Bay Water Utility sitting on that coalition. So we're all talking amongst our various constituencies, trying to educate everybody about all of the potential sources and programs that are out there to help remediate that.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Arendt, Director of the Environmental Management and Business Institute at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us today to talk about lead abatement programs in his part of the state, an up-close local look at a big national issue. The EPA just released some new rules. They announced them this week in Green Bay. Coming up, electric vehicles are becoming more of a big thing. We'll learn more about a new order by Amazon for some electric vans. 100,000 of them, actually. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we check in on some top stories from around Wisconsin, including a big drug bust in the Appleton area. Now, do you hear a buzzing sound in front of your house, expecting an Amazon delivery? Might not be a drone. It could be an electric van. Amazon recently put in an order for 100,000 of them with the electric automaker Rivian. Earlier today, we talked to longtime automotive journalist Micheline Maynard about the state of the electric vehicle industry and this latest development. Micheline, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Well, a lot of people, I think, look at electric vehicles and think cars, but it turns out there's this developing market for things like pickup trucks, delivery vans, and more. Where are we as this develops right now?
Well, I'm pretty amazed by it because this has pretty much happened under the radar. So you're starting to see electric delivery vans. And let me just say that I believe postal vehicles, you know, those little Jeeps and things driven by the postal companies, those have always been electric. Those have always plugged in. So we've had electric delivery vehicles for quite a while, but now we're starting to see them on a commercial basis. And I think that surprises people who think of, you know, Tesla and some of the other electric vehicle brands as representing what there is in EVs.
Yeah, Tesla is kind of a household word now, but there's this company I hadn't even heard of called Rivian, and all of a sudden Amazon says we want, what, 100,000 delivery vans, electric delivery vans, something like that?
I'm very intrigued by Rivian. For one thing, they're right down the road from me in Ann Arbor. They're in Plymouth, Michigan, which is about a half an hour west of Detroit. They've been around, I believe, since about 2010. They bought the old Mitsubishi plant down in Normal, Illinois. So for a little while, there was a Chrysler-Mitsubishi joint venture project employing American workers, and I think they were UAW members. So that went under, or went out of business, I should say, and Rivian bought the factory. They've been planning to introduce an electric pickup and an electric SUV, and production is supposed to start there next year. Apparently, somehow, this got on Jeff Bezos's radar at Amazon. And now they've got literally more orders than we think they can handle.
Talk about the logistical challenges here, not just, you know, designing new vehicles and building them and successfully selling them, but maintenance. They're not going to have dealerships, as I understand it, around the country and existing auto shops. This might be an alien technology to them. How do we maintain a fleet of vehicles like this?
Well, first of all, you have to plug them in. So you're talking about 100,000 electric delivery vans that will go on grids across the country. Now, people might have noticed that there are plug-in stations in a lot of parking lots and parking structures and on the college campuses. So it isn't an alien thing anymore to see a plug-in for an electric vehicle, but this is a lot of vehicles. So they're going to have charging stations. And, you know, with the Amazon folks, they've been using the U.S. Post Office. They've been using FedEx. They've been using just independent contractors. I was on their website the other day, and they're very actively looking for delivery drivers. So will the people who work for Amazon as delivery drivers have to have a charger at home? Those are all questions that we don't know the answer to, but you can say that 100,000 vehicles joining the electrical grid could be a challenge in parts of the country where the grid is under pressure.
Rivian is its own startup, but I understand Ford is an investor in Rivian as well. So it's this hybrid new company, old company sort of situation?
Kind of. Ford put about $500 million into Rivian, and Rivian has been very successful in raising money. They've had $1.5 billion of investment over the last couple of years. So this seems to be the project that everyone is looking at as the one that could make it. And I think Tesla would say, well, look at us. But, you know, Tesla's had all kinds of challenges through the years in getting its vehicles out the door, having smooth production and making money. So Rivian might be the one that learns from what's happened to Tesla and goes forward, but in a commercial, more of a commercial sense. I have to say the pickups and SUVs will be focused on consumers, but it might be commercial vehicles where they really become successful.
We are talking about the latest in electric vehicles, including electric delivery vans, with Micheline Maynard, longtime reporter covering the auto industry. How much of the electrical vehicle market is coming from startups, newer companies like Rivian, versus auto companies that we've heard of that have been in the auto business for a lot of years?
Well, the electric vehicles that people probably know are Tesla, Nissan, General Motors. BMW has done some work with electrics. Toyota has done some work with electrics. But in terms of cracking the retail market, it's been GM, Nissan, and Tesla. So when people start to see these Rivian, Amazon delivery vehicles running around, it may wake them up a little bit to electric vehicles, assuming that there aren't the Teslas and the others in their markets.
Rivian is getting a lot of attention now. Are there other companies out there trying to crack this pickup truck van delivery market?
It's interesting because there were more companies that were looking into it because there were federal tax credits available, and the Obama administration was very aggressive in trying to push investments in electric vehicles, but the Trump administration has not been as aggressive in that. There's a company called Cox Automotive that I don't know if anyone's ever heard of it outside the auto industry, but they put $350 million into Rivian, and this is a big name in logistics. And I don't think you can turn all these electric vehicles out onto the street without, you know, some thought behind it. The other thing that Rivian is doing is it's looking at self-driving vehicles. It's trying to design platforms so you can drive them right-hand, left-hand drive, and then eventually self-driving. But I think self-driving is not going to come on quite as fast as some people were expecting. And we're likely to see more EVs first and more assisted driving vehicles later on.
You mentioned that Rivian is down the street from you. Further down the street is the Henry Ford Museum, where you can read long, long lists of automakers that lived and died in the early days of the industry. Are we there again with a lot of companies that are trying to tap this electric market, and maybe a few will survive to tell the tale?
When I was a little girl, my town used to have a 4th of July parade, and there would always be an electric vehicle from the 1900s, not anything like an EV1 or anything like that, but electric vehicles, and a steam-powered vehicle, a Stanley Steamer. Mm-hmm. And so I do remember seeing these on the streets when I was a very little girl. So now I think it's fascinating to watch because clearly there's kind of a tacit understanding that the internal combustion engine will not be the only thing powering cars going into the future. I happen to own a Prius, and it's 10 years old now, but I'm still getting 50 miles to the gallon from it, you know, with battery and gasoline power. So it took about 20 years for the Prius to become a household name. We're maybe 5 years into the electric vehicle wave of this century. But if we did this interview again in 2030 or 2035, we might be talking about, hey, we're seeing electric vehicles everywhere. How did that happen?
You mentioned that Rivian was maybe learning from some of the pratfalls of Tesla over the years. How so? What are the things that they're doing differently that might, by 2030, make them a success story?
One of the things that Tesla did was it went very high in the market. It went into luxury vehicles first. So the original Tesla sedan, not the Model S and certainly not the current Model 3, the first Tesla was extremely expensive. I think it was over $100,000. Now, the first Rivians that people can buy are not going to be cheap either. I think the SUV is going to cost about $72,000 and the pickup will cost $69,000. So those are not cheap, but they're not $100,000 vehicles. So I think what they've learned is they're starting where the Model S did. So they're starting a level down from where Tesla started. They've certainly are looking at volume. So this factory down in Normal, Illinois is supposed to have a capacity of 200,000 vehicles and I think 1,000 employees. That's pretty aggressive for an electric vehicle manufacturer at this point in time. I mean, that's the size of a regular assembly plant. Of course, it was a regular assembly plant. So they're looking at volume. They're looking at a price that's sort of accessible. I mean, I'm not going to go buy a $72,000 electric SUV, but there might be somebody who goes and leases one, and that would be probably the way a lot of people will go into the market. And they've got money. And I think this is just one of the things that happens to all startups is that people get a fantastic idea. They get some seed funding. But then when they go out to grow, they don't have that big influx of cash that they need. And it sounds like Rivian has a business plan. It has investors. It has products. You know, it has all the things that look really good on paper. Now we just have to see them build some.
We've been talking about production of electric vehicles here in the United States. When I hear about industries like solar panels and wind turbines, I hear often that there are other countries that are out ahead of us in that kind of production. Are there other countries around the globe that you're watching that are maybe doing better or on a pace with the U.S. in electric vehicles?
Yes, I watch other countries all the time because it's easier, you know, and people are saying, oh, why can't we be like Denmark and why can't we be like Finland and whatever? We're a heck of a big country. You know, you might get it in a state. You might get it in Minnesota. You might get it in Michigan or Connecticut. But we're not going to have these national waves the way you see them in places like Denmark where bicycles are probably the preferred choice to automobiles. And Israel has talked about only allowing electric vehicles in the future. France is cracking down on diesel vehicles. You have these days in Paris where there's no traffic on the Champs-Élysées and you can only walk or bike or scooter or whatever. Latin American countries are looking at it. Asian countries are looking at it. And so I think everywhere around the world, the seed has been planted for alternatives to traditional cars and trucks. We're just such a big country that it's going to happen almost anecdotally versus sweeping the country. But that's how trends start in the United States. They might start in St. Paul and then spread to Kansas City and go down to Austin and show up in New Orleans. And then all of a sudden, you've got dots on a map that you can almost connect. So I don't discount the possibility of more EVs at all. I think that it may take community efforts. It may take a city like Ann Arbor buying 10,000 of these electric vehicles, or, you know, Mankato buying 5,000 of them, or Milwaukee saying we're only going to allow electric vehicles on four streets downtown. And that's how these trends get started.
Mickey, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Micheline Maynard, automotive business and food writer. She's also a lecturer in journalism at the University of Michigan. We talked to her today about the electric vehicle market and the startup company Rivian. By the way, the Ideas Network will air the candidate debate in the Democratic presidential race. They'll face each other for their next debate on Tuesday night at 7. Join us for live coverage and analysis from NPR. That's Tuesday night at 7 here on the Ideas Network, or stream it online. That's at WPR.org. Things are cooling off in Wisconsin after some late summer-like weather. There are freeze warnings in most of the state, I think, and some snow coming to northern Wisconsin, though it looks like we're going to miss the bulk of the big snow moving across the plains. Producer Jay Carlisle Larson, for one, welcomes our new cold weather overlord. Hey, JC.
Oh, hey. I am psyched. I'm so glad it's finally cold. I can't deal with warm weather
right,
at
some
all.
People mourn the passing of summer and this, unseasonably yeah. nice weather we've had the last couple of weeks.
That is not
part.
Something that I identify with. I have basically been, I like summer for maybe a week and a half every year, and then the rest of the year could be, you know, low 50s, maybe high 40s.
Right, but you know, you understand that this means that the winter, as they say on that hipster TV show, is coming.
That hipster show.
You're yeah. okay. You're willing to accept the impending looming snow. And,
oh,
and,
absolutely.
And
I mean,
us?
I know that I'm like kind of in the minority here, but I actually really like Wisconsin winters. I can deal with the negative degree temperatures for a big chunk of time. I'm fine with that.
And I'm finding as I get older, I appreciate or I am bothered by winter less and by yeah. summer more. I fold like a tulip now in hot, humid weather, and I don't want to do anything.
Yeah, I don't either. But I do want to sit at home and drink tea and like maybe just sit under a blanket. That sounds awesome to me. Sounds like a good use of my time.
All right. I will meditate on your ways as winter comes. JC, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Central Time.